You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts on Spotify or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good afternoon. I'm David Wessel, Director of the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy at the Brookings Institution on behalf of the Hutchins Center and the Initiative on Global Markets at the Chicago Booth School of Business. I'd like to welcome you to this event. We're presenting the report of a task force on financial stability that began work in October 2019, before the pandemic, and worked through the pandemic quite efficiently virtually to look at what's our issues remaining that expose us to financial vulnerabilities beyond those that were repaired after the global financial crisis. Before we get to our program, I want to thank the members of the task force, Lori Goodman, Kate Judge, Anil Keshep, Ralph Koijan, Blythe Masters, Sadie O'Connor, and Kara Stein, as well as the co-chairs, Glenn Hubbard and Don Cohn, who you'll hear from in a minute. I also want to thank a couple of people on the Brookings staff, Stephanie Sensul and Hao-Wen Chen, who helped keep this thing going. Our plan this afternoon is that for the first half hour, Glenn Hubbard and Don Cohn will summarize the report. And then we've convened a panel with some members of the task force and a couple of other distinguished scholars, Randy Krosner from Chicago and Jeremy Stein from Harvard, and we'll discuss that. If you have questions, you can't ask them through your mouth, but you can ask them through your fingertips on Slido, SLI.DO, hashtag financial stability, or on Twitter, and we'll try and get to those if we can. Copies of the report are available on our website. And now I'd like to turn the program over to Don and Glenn. Thank you.
Thanks, David. Let me echo your thank yous, but add a couple, one to you for your outstanding work in this, and one to all the many experts who came to talk with us from academia, from regulation, and from markets. To start out with just some simple definitions, why are we here? The idea of financial stability is really to focus on a financial system supplying reliable credit intermediation and other financial services at a rate where the economy would grow at a sustainable pace. We focused a lot on instability, the flip side of that, arising from externalities, from excessive leverage, from either maturity or liquidity mismatches, interconnection, correlated exposures, and so on. As David said, we really tried to identify gaps post-global financial crisis and in the U.S. post-Dodd-Frank regulatory architecture that really stand in the way of resilience toward this definition of financial stability that I mentioned. In some sense, the efforts in the global financial crisis and just after were quite focused on banks and did, in fact, shore up banks. So our attention has really been focused on non-bank financial intermediation and on markets. And indeed, I think it's fair to say, if not obvious, that in March of 2020, as the pandemic was taking root, the system failed a live stress test. An analogy that Don and I have used a lot in talking with the group relates to fire prevention. And fire prevention is more than just putting out a fire when you see it, which is sort of the classic regulation steps in ex post. It's about two other things. One, it's hopefully preventing buildup of combustible materials in the first place. If I'm not torturing the analogy too much, think of that as policy. But it's also learning how to smell smoke, and that is going to be process. So we're going to talk about in the report today both policy recommendations and process recommendations that get at financial stability. We didn't tackle everything. There's some very important topics that we left out for reasons of time or expertise. But we do believe, and come back to this at the end, that were the approaches we suggested to have been used, 2020 might have gone a little bit differently. In terms of the topics you'll hear about at a high level and can read about in the report, you see first in the pie charts there, the huge increase in the role of non-bank finance, which is why we're focusing there. So we're going to talk first about Treasury market liquidity. That was the dysfunction in March, but it actually happened before March of 2020 as well. Most important market in the world. Open-end mutual funds, in particular money market funds and bond funds. Housing finance, which was a key player, obviously, in the previous crisis. Derivatives clearing houses, or CCPs. Insurance companies. And then segueing from policy to how you address all this, we take a pretty significant stab at regulatory structure and process with suggestions on how to do it better. So that's a quick guide to the report. For those of you who want to go back and read the report, you'll find our principal diagnoses and recommendations all listed out at the beginning and at the end of each chapter. So now I'll pass the baton to my colleague, Don Cohn, to begin the discussion on the Treasury market.
Thank you, Glenn. So the Treasury market is the key global market. It's used as a base, the U.S. Treasury market. It's used as a base to price other securities. U.S. Treasuries, especially in the U.S., constitute most of the pool of highly liquid assets that banks and others hold to meet unexpected withdrawals and other demands for funding liquidity. When the Treasury market is disrupted, the financial markets are disrupted, and credit to households and businesses is adversely affected, not only the government borrowing. And it was badly disrupted back in March. And you can see from this chart, we were in the middle of a shutdown for the pandemic. There was a huge amount of uncertainty. Equity markets were dropping. And that's a situation in which people flee to the most safe and liquid asset. And yet, Treasury yields started to rise in the middle of all that. It was an extreme event. The Treasury market was not performing its functions. In the end, the Federal Reserve had to intervene with massive purchases to restore market functioning, and through restoring Treasury market functioning, help to restore functioning in the rest of the market. So we have a number of recommendations to help Treasury market functioning going forward. I should say that what happened last March was extreme and difficult, but there were hints of problems before that. So the Treasury markets were on our radar before last March. Here are our recommendations. And here again, I think we don't have any one recommendation that's going to fix the problem. We think that it needs to be approached from multiple different perspectives at the same time. So we looked at both the demand and supply of market liquidity in Treasury markets. We have some recommendations to reduce the demand for market liquidity, which we'll get to with our discussion of open-end funds and margining it in central clearing counterparties. On the supply side of Treasury market liquidity, we have a number of recommendations to increase the private sector's capacity to make markets and also the public sector. On the private side, we want to look at regulatory requirements on banks and bank holding companies and their dealer subsidiaries to see whether they can be adjusted to free up market-making capacity without reducing the resilience of the banking sector built up since the global financial crisis. We give some examples, the leverage ratio, G-SIB surcharges, but we also ask the regulator to take a broader review of the regulations, including of overlapping liquidity requirements, to see whether their adverse effect on the Treasury market is serious and requires adjustment. We also asked the regulators to look at central clearing of treasuries and treasury repo that would enable netting and free up capital in the dealers so they could make markets. And finally, we've asked to set up a Federal Reserve backstop for this most systemic market, a repo facility at a penalty rate, just in the budget playbook, open to highly regulated bank dealers and non-bank dealers, but also open to other less regulated entities like principal trading firms, hedge funds, but those less regulated entities would be charged an upfront fee, a small upfront fee, to mitigate the moral hazard. Think of it as an insurance fee. Firms whose trading was so large as to be systemic would be required to buy the insurance. Others could join on a voluntary basis. And I'll pass it back to Glenn for the open-end mutual funds.
Thanks, Don. The open-end mutual funds is an example, going back to what I said at the beginning, of issues raised in liquidity and maturity transformation that can create externalities. So we focused on the following problem, that money market funds and some bond funds are offering daily redemption, but are holding, in some cases, longer-term securities that couldn't be sold, particularly in a crisis, without significant price concessions. If nothing else happened, that creates a kind of first mover advantage, where in stress, some investors will run to the head of the line to be the first to withdraw funds, which can lead the mutual funds to dump their treasuries first, feeding on a problem Don had identified first, those being their most liquid assets, and then after that, potential fire sales of their less liquid assets. Both the spillover to the treasury market and in the other asset markets can cause disruptions. Now, is this a problem? Yes, we've seen, as the figure shows, quite significant inflows in the past few years in open and bond funds. And we certainly saw a huge outflow at the onset of the pandemic. So what do we recommend? Really a couple of things. First, for prime money market funds to adopt swing pricing and or redemption fees. So the idea in swing pricing is not to have those who are rushing to the first in the line impose a negative price effect on remaining investors. So it would require the pricing to net out that benefit and reduce the first mover advantage. And we argue in the report, this reduces, if not eliminates, the first mover advantage problem. And we also recommend eliminating the connection between liquidity buffers and gates that has had been a problem. For other open-end funds, we're thinking about open-end bond funds here, we would, and we spell this out in the report, require swing pricing where it's sensible. In some cases, we might need to create a new category of funds that had more limited liquidity than the standard open-end daily redemption feature and migrate some asset classes to that. The idea in all of this is not to tell people what they should invest in, but to simply remind people what's liquid and what's not, and what's the true cost of liquidity. The reason to force that internalization are the externalities that come from the lack of its internalization during a crisis. So we think these reforms are important. We think they are doable, and we spell out some mechanics in the report. The next category we go to, I'll pick this up, is on housing finance. Housing, of course, was the major player in the global financial crisis, or at least a major player. Here, we're looking at major problems that are not all dissimilar from what we faced before. One is an aggregate demand spillover if households are over their skis in debt. A second that is more concentrated here, given post-global financial crisis reforms, a disruption potentially to credit supply if non-bank servicers fail. Servicing moved out of bank solution to non-bank solution after the global financial crisis, and a new fragility was suggested. And of course, there's spillovers to other asset classes if there's a disruption in the mortgage securities market. And you can see just in the chart we present there, of Ginnie Mae servicing, the share owned by non-bank servicers has risen dramatically, highlighting the potential concern. So what do we recommend, sort of mapping into the problems that I just identified? On the borrower side, we would look to residual income caps for owner-occupied properties. And by residual income cap, just mean questions about the borrower covering debt after taking into account living expenses out of income. So this is different from the standard debt to income measure. And also loan to value caps on investor properties and cash out refinancing. Second relates to crisis issues. We want to have a toolkit ready and on the books to streamline refinancing and forbearance during national emergencies. We groped toward this a bit during the global financial crisis. Of course, we did it again during the pandemic. We argue for a more systematic approach. Related to a point Don made about the Treasury market and a Bagehot-style backstop facility, we would also propose the creation of a central liquidity facility for government-backed mortgage securities, also at a penalty rate, as with Treasury. Now, for the non-bank servicers that have become so important, we did a lot of analysis on the existence of or lack thereof, more to the point of prudential regulations. So we would make the FHFA the prudential regulator for the non-bank servicers and require it to account for systemic risk when it's overseeing Fannie and Freddie and the Federal Home Loan Banks. And then we would allow non-bank, I should say, servicers to be Federal Home Loan Bank members. We feel this package of recommendations addresses the over-leveraged spillover on the borrower side and also the credit disruption from the systemic non-bank services. So Don, I'll pass it back to you.
Insurance companies are a critical element in the financial system. They facilitate risk sharing and mitigation for their customers, and they are a major source of finance for businesses. Insurance companies that might face problems could reduce lending to businesses, offerings of insurance products to the public, and that would spill over to the economy. Now, we saw that actually occur in the 2008-2009 global financial crisis, and a lot of improvements have been made in regulation and the operation of insurance companies since then, but there are still some potential vulnerabilities that we focused on. In particular, insurance companies sell variable annuities, which have a guaranteed minimum rate of return. And insurance companies have engaged in some reinsurance in shadow or captive reinsurance offshore. They establish offshore affiliates where they park risks but hold less capital than they would if those risks were kept in the United States. And a real problem here is a lack of transparency, just how much risk is there, both in the variable annuities and in the offshore reinsurance. So our recommendations were importantly to increase transparency. So figure out whether there is a problem about the sensitivity of insurance companies to changes in financial conditions, and about the capital relief provided by these captive reinsurance companies. We want to have standardized stress tests of insurers and state guarantee funds so that we, the regulators, both the state regulators that have the primary authority here, but also the federal level, we can be more certain just how strong the insurance companies are and whether there are weaknesses there. And we would like to give the Federal Insurance Office in the Treasury Department additional authority to coordinate across states on transparency and the stress tests. I think the next category is the clearinghouses for derivatives. So you can see the central counterparty is illustrated in that chart on the right there. So without a central counterparty, all these parties are trading with each other. With a central counterparty, they're trading with that central counterparty. and they perform a valuable role in the financial system that is making the CCP the central counterparty for transactions, allows netting by all those folks to save capital, and facilitates transparency, and it can help users manage risk. They can see what they've got better. And that's why Dodd-Frank actually mandated increased use of central counterparties. But they also concentrate risk. As you can see, everything's going through that central counterparty. Problems at a CCP can readily spread broadly through the markets because those problems cause those critical markets for risk management, the derivative markets or the securities markets, to cease to function well, or because the problems are pushed onto the clearing members, many of which themselves are critical to market functioning and are members of multiple CCPs. So greatly increased margin calls from CCPs were one source of the demand for Treasury liquidity in the March 2020 dash for cash that led to fire sales of Treasuries and other assets. Securities CCPs tend to be member-owned, but the most important derivative CCPs are for-profit, and that has created a misalignment of interest between the CCP and the members. For-profit CCPs are incented to hold as little capital as possible at risk and to push the losses onto the members with the potential types of consequences we discussed. So we have a number of recommendations for dealing with the financial stability risks of CCPs. I think the first one is to bring the Fed into a more active role in oversight, so we can take advantage of the Fed's systemic risk perspective and its macro and markets expertise. The Fed has some role in the oversight of CCPs or market utilities that were designated as systemically important, but we would like to ramp up that oversight and the activity of the Fed to get its perspective. We want to adopt more through the cycle margining so that bouts of volatility don't build on themselves by provoking huge margin calls as they did in March, which then are met by sales that increase the volatility. And that was an amplification process. So we'd like to get the margins up in peacetime so they don't have to rise so far when problems hit. We'd like to strengthen, the Fed should work with the CFTC and the CCPs to strengthen and regularize stress testing standards and transparency. And the resilience of the CCP should be strengthened and the interests of the members and the CCPs better aligned by increasing CCP's skin in the game, that is the capital that they put up, the owners put up themselves, and clarifying and limiting the amount and techniques for passing losses back to members in troubled times. So I'll pass it back to you, Glenn.
Thanks. So to regulatory structure and process, you know, if you think of a continuum of policy on the one hand and the age-old adage that personnel is policy on the other, in the middle is what's the structure and process by which regulation takes place? We think there's a lot to do here. Basically, if you step back, our goal was to say, how can regulation be a bit more dynamic? How can it look at changes that have clearly happened in a market or set of institutions, say over the past 2 or 3 years, and anticipate what might happen in the event of a crisis? We felt that there were a number of issues standing in the way, having to do with attention and organization and accountability. The picture there is of the FSOC annual report, which I'll come back to, but we identified really three major problems. One is an inconsistent attention to financial stability across members of the FSOC. Many members, each of whom is trying to do the job Congress gave it, we felt are not always paying attention to financial stability, which is not just a comment in a crisis, but to this issue of what's changing, what should we be looking for? A second area of concern that we identified is actually just too little accountability for an agency or agency head in identifying these financial stability risks in advance and recommending action. And then a third very important piece is insufficiently comprehensive financial data. This ability to see around the corners, to look at what's happened in the past, obviously requires data. And we think that this is a big issue. So what do we recommend? We would start with something very explicit, simple to say, but perhaps challenging in political economy to do, to give each agency a very explicit financial stability mandate. So each agency would have an internal financial stability office. A mandate would be required to be accountable to Congress and the public for its views on what's happening in its purview on issues of financial stability. We would further focus accountability by taking the FSOC report, whose picture showed on the previous slide, and making the Secretary of the Treasury the sole author of the report. So she, Janet Yellen, the current secretary, would be accountable for that. Each agency, though, would have appendices and commentary with its own comments, with interactions among the agencies and the FSOC chair, the Secretary of the Treasury. As we recommended for the other agencies, under the Secretary of the Treasury would be a new Undersecretary of Treasury for financial stability with the staff. The Treasury Secretary, whomever he or she is very busy with lots of issues. This would concentrate this responsibility and help manage day-to-day issues in FSOC. We feel that existing Treasury undersecretaries already have a full plate and that this new position is important, not only in stress times, but importantly in non-stress times to identify the potential for issues. I mentioned data before. We would make modifications to the Office of Financial Research, which was created after the global financial crisis. Our purpose here is not to be critical of what OFR does, but to try to empower it or a successor to it to do more. We would modify the structure of OFR to a Comptroller for Data and Resilience. The name is important there. The word comptroller is obviously trying to pull in and draw to mind the stature and importance of the comptroller of the currency. And data and resilience are trying to get at stability. And we would have this comptroller for data and resilience be a voting member of FSOC, along with the agency constituencies. Now, in terms of putting reforms into practice, or you could really say to test, it's a fair question to ask. Okay, you folks spent all this time since October 2019. What if we did the counterfactual and said we'd had some or all of these changes in place when we went through the stress test the world gave us in the pandemic? What might we have seen coming if these proposals had been adopted? Now, of course, there are no silver bullets, as Don began in the Treasury, and we've said repeatedly, but we do believe in the Treasury market dysfunction, we would have caught the issues underlying challenges in liquidity. Don referred to a number of supply and demand considerations that were there, not just in the pandemic. We know there was an episode the fall before, and the characteristics were structural, and the policy actions could have been suggested. In mutual funds, the process would have picked up big changes in open-end bond funds and asked the questions about the liquidity transformation and maturity transformation happening there, not with an eye towards saying you shouldn't have it, but with an eye towards saying, is that liquidity transformation and maturity transformation being fairly priced? And on CCPs, had there been a financial stability mandate, there would have been more discussion of issues about incentives in CCPs and the potential for fire sales. So we view all of this as important. I do want to mention things that we talked about briefly in the report, but we did not give them the attention they rightly deserve. Issues of emerging risks such as climate change and cybersecurity risks. These are both first order for obvious reasons. We did not tackle them for two reasons. One was to focus on financial stability in a timely way to help the administration and Congress. The other is we felt as a group, we didn't have the domain expertise to have a lot to say really on climate change and cybersecurity, though we do acknowledge them as risks. So I will conclude there, and really going back to where I began, the framing is about financial stability and instability. The framing is about how do you see this coming? So what are the areas you need to look at? What are the policies to consider? What are the process changes that help consider it? And that was our work on the task force for financial stability.
Thank you very much, Don and Glenn. That was an excellent summary of a report that's 125 pages and goes into great detail on each of those topics. I think it's sometimes hard for novices to understand any particular issue, but we wanted to give people an overview. Now, to discuss this, I'm joined by a number of people with particular expertise. First, there are members of the task force, Blythe Masters from Motive Partners, who has a distinguished career in finance and a collection of motorcycles in the background. Anil Keshup from the University of Chicago and Kate Judge from Columbia Law School. And I'm also joined by two people we recruited to help comment on the report, Jeremy Stein from Harvard and Randy Krosner from the University of Chicago. Randy and Jeremy have done substantial academic work in this area. They both also have served on the Federal Reserve Board. Now, I should mention that we picked the members of the task force because of their expertise, and several of them have conflicts of interest, which we have disclosed in the report. One thing to mention in particular that Anil is currently a member of the Financial Policy Committee of the Bank of England, but in this conversation, he is not speaking for the Bank of England or Boris Johnson or anybody else. He's speaking only for himself. My experience is that when Anil speaks for himself, it's usually pretty interesting. So I'm not worried about him tempering his comments. I want to start with Jeremy and Randy, and I'm interested in your reaction to this report. Let me start with you, Jeremy. And particularly, I think the task force felt that the non-bank financial system, sometimes known as the shadow banking system, is a huge financial stability risk. It's one that has been identified by some people in the past, and the task force is trying to call attention to it. And I wonder whether you share that alarm and what you think of their recommendations.
Okay, well, thanks, David, and thanks for including me. Yeah, I do. I should say this is a terrific and very wide-ranging report, and I agree with a lot of the recommendations. And I also very much appreciate the sort of careful effort to link the recommendations to well-identified externalities, which was really well done. So there's an awful lot, as you said, it's a big, big report. There's an awful lot. Let me just pick and choose, and I'll focus on two of the chapters, open-end bond funds and the treasury market. So David, to your question, I was particularly happy to see you all take on open-end bond funds. And that's to say all bond funds, not just money market funds. As you said, this has been a pretty worrying source of vulnerability. And I know that some observers and particularly folks on this task force have been expressing worries for some time. And I think March 2020 really validated some of these concerns, though unfortunately for empirical science, the Fed kind of ruined the experiment by stepping in and basically saving the bond market with the primary and the secondary corporate credit facilities. I mean, obviously, unfortunately for science, fortunately for the real economy, because I think this could have gotten really extremely ugly through sort of this liquidation mechanism and credit disruption. I mean, the one concern I guess I have is because the full ugliness didn't play out, some of the policy urgency may be somewhat tempered. And in fact, if you're an industry advocate, you might be tempted to say, well, look, it wasn't really all that bad. It wasn't really all that bad, A, because the Fed saved you, and B, we should worry that they were able to do that really because this was an alien invasion. And they had much more political support in the form of the CARES Act and many other sort of things that allowed them to intervene in the corporate bond market in a way that they can't in normal times. It's very different than the treasury market where the Fed can basically always step in. So I think it's just an incredibly important area. I think it's great that you all flagged it. And I want to say I agree with basically the general spirit here, which I think it was very important. The point that swing pricing, while it can be helpful for dealing with first mover advantages, is unlikely to be a panacea. And you may need to consider things that are a little bit more structural and a little bit more aggressive. So just to be very clear on kind of the economic mechanisms, if you thought that the only market failure was a first mover advantage, that some people can get out better at a better price, then I think you'd be inclined to like sort of well-designed swing pricing, because if you get the swing pricing right, it sort of internalizes, it makes the first mover internalize their advantage relative to those that stay behind. But I think that the thing to note is that while the first mover advantage is no doubt one factor that contributes to instability here, it's unlikely to be the only one. And basically any kind of positive feedback mechanism, whether it's people who extrapolate from past returns, whether it's stop loss, margin calls, flat out panic, all of those can interact with the open end structure in a way that can kind of create a spiral that goes from outflows to price declines to further outflows. One clue that it's not all just about first mover comes from exchange traded funds, from ETFs. In other words, if you thought that the only problem in the world was first mover, you'd love ETFs, because basically they have an endogenous form of swing pricing whereby the price of the ETF can decline under stress well below forcing people to eat their own price pressure. So if you thought that was the only problem, you'd say, I love ETFs. Now, interestingly, ETFs also had very large outflows during the same stress period, which again suggests that the only problem to be addressed is not just first mover, but it's something more inherent to kind of this just maturity mismatch thing. So I think that's sort of very important on the part of the report. As to the specific recommendation of creating a new class of funds that are not quite open and not quite closed, I think there's a lot of detail still to be filled in here. We probably need some kind of legislation. I'm not quite sure how you decide who goes in which bucket. And so I have a hard time kind of commenting on the specifics because they're yet to be developed. But again, I think the important thing that the report does is flag that we may need to think in this sort of more ambitious and structural way. And again, I very much agree with that. On to treasuries. First thing to say, and Don kind of touched on this, March 2020 is sort of the motivation for maybe the most compelling motivation. I don't think we're going to solve with any of the things we're talking about, you know, for a counterfactual world where March 2020 would have gone smoothly. It was just an enormous, you know, six sigma, eight sigma, pick your thing, enormous event. And, you know, this huge dash for cash is basically just a very dramatic shift in the preference for reserves relative to bonds. And until the Fed massively expands the supply of reserves, you're going to have to get a pretty dramatic price. And so some of that, any market structure is going to have that. So it's not to say that there are not a lot of things that can be improved, but I don't think you want to tell yourself that these improvements would have made March 2020 go smoothly. On the specifics, totally agree with the recommendation on defanging effectively the binding nature of the leverage ratio, which is really, I think it was anticipatable, but if it's been made worse by the dramatic increase in reserves, is really problematic for market making in particular. So agree with that. And I also agree with the proviso that you don't want to just sort of dial back the leverage ratio without making a compensating adjustment, presumably to risk-based capital, so as to keep the overall dollars of capital in the banking system the same. So I totally agree there. I also agree on the usefulness of a standing repo facility. I'm also sort of strongly supportive of that. I think here I differ somewhat, actually maybe sharply, with the design. I favor a broad access standing repo facility. And in particular, I don't like the feature that you all seem to want to charge an upfront fee for the standing repo facility. I would like to make it as broad access as feasible with no fee, with an appropriate haircut so the Fed is well protected, but with no fee. I think it, the fee sort of runs into an externality, which is we like the standing repo facility in part because if people access the facility and can borrow against their treasuries, they don't have to fire sell them. And you want to cut off the fire sale. And so the concern is if you charge people, they may be less inclined to public good in some sense to avoid the fire sale. So you don't want to have this fee that discourages it. And I have to say that, you know, the moral hazard problem that we're sort of trying to solve for with this fee, I've never seen it. I don't see a well-designed and well-collateralized, this is for treasuries. This is not, would not be for other things. But if you're pledging treasuries with an adequate haircut, the Fed doesn't lose money. And the idea that hedge funds are going to like somehow make out like bandits, I think about a hedge fund that's doing the treasury futures basis trade. If they do, they may behaviorally change. They may lever more. What's going to happen? The spreads will collapse. They will drive the spread, you know, towards zero. That is to say, they will push up the price and drive down the yield on treasuries to the benefit of the taxpayer. It's not to the benefit of a corporate issuer in this case. It's to the benefit of the taxpayers in some getting their fee by the fact that treasuries are seen. It's a feature of treasuries that they are intraday monetizable. You pay for that up front, the government benefits, the Fed doesn't lose again if it's well collateralized. So I think that's basically a win-win. And I don't see the moral hazard in the way I would with a facility where you are pledging, say, corporate securities. If you're really determined to address the moral hazard here, maybe you'd want to investigate some system of having minimum haircuts on treasuries ex ante. But I think the Fed would need to get the legal authority to do that. Last thing I'll say is sort of just a nagging feeling. I think there are a lot of good ideas here, and they're all well worth doing. I don't know how much they will solve problems in treasury market more generally, even some of these other flash episodes. I think the underlying fundamental economic problem is it is very efficient. PTF firms are an example of this. It is very efficient to run a capital light model 99 days out of 100. You don't use a lot of capital. You sort of force spreads to be narrow, and that just works well. And that's going to win in almost any kind of market setting. That capital light model will just evolution, you know, Darwinianly kind of tend to take over. And that model does well most of the time. And it's just not good when there are sort of one in 100 events. So without really kind of getting at that, again, all this other stuff is useful, but if you ask me to bet, will we still, if this were adopted, will we still have flash crashes and things like that? I think the answer might be yes. So all good. Want to probably be a little humble about what we can solve, but again, right. a terrific report.
Well, thank you for that, Jeremy. I think on behalf of the task force, I don't think anybody in the task force thinks we're going to eliminate all crises. We're just hoping to minimize both the frequency and the severity of them by putting some measures in place that will increase the resiliency of the system. Randy, I'm curious in your reaction. And one of the things we've heard from some people is, oh, you guys want the Fed to take over everything. You know, the Fed's going to take care of CCPs, right? And the Fed's going to be running a giant refinancing facility for everything from mortgages to treasury repo and who knows what. And I'm just sort of curious whether you share that anxiety and what your other reactions are to the report.
Sure. No, I think that's an important point. And thank you very much for bringing me in to comment on this excellent report. I just want to say that I really like that the approach that's taken, very clear objectives, clarifying what people mean by financial stability and financial resilience. Those words are used a lot without any clarity. As Jeremy said, the linkage between some sort of challenge in the market and a particular solution is very clear. That's also very rare because often there are solutions in search of problems. And here we actually try to identify, you know, in the report, try to identify the problems clearly and then identify the solutions, making it easy to decide whether you agree that it's solving the problem or not. Thinking in terms of cost benefit, not in the narrow terms of we're going to like calculate this is this costs 42 cents and that costs 43 cents. And so we do the one that costs 42 cents. We'll never get that kind of precision. But being honest about the trade-offs and being clear about the trade-offs. So I just wanted to say that I think that's extremely valuable and very rare in this kind of analysis, and extraordinarily welcome. On the Fed's reach, it's always very easy to say, well, why doesn't just the Fed do it? I mean, they seem like a bunch of smart people and they got a lot of resources and kind of that's where the money is. And also in times of crisis, it does seem like the Fed is the one that reacts boldly and reacts quickly. Actually, it's kind of interesting that many people thought that with the passage of Dodd-Frank and the reduction of some of those so-called the emergency powers, the Section 13(3) powers, the Fed had to kind of do things just with a supermajority of the board, with five votes or more of the board, that was going to be slowed down because now you have to go to Treasury. Clearly, March of 2020 shows that that's not necessarily the case. The Fed was able to stand up all the programs that we had pioneered when Bernanke, myself, and others were there, plus a whole lot more. The interesting part, and this relates to your question, David, is that what Congress did is actually appropriate money for additional activities, Main Street lending program, a whole variety of other things. And of course, that was just crisis time and such. But it's sort of interesting that it was the Congress giving money to the Treasury to tell the Fed what to do. That had never really happened before. Now, that's not directly telling the Fed what to do about monetary policy, but it's starting to get closer to a line. And this is the thing that I worry about, that if you think that, well, no one else really can do it, the Fed can always do it. It takes, when you have a less clear objective or when you have multiple objectives, it becomes difficult, more difficult for accountability. And it becomes more difficult, I think, to be successful in your core mission. That's not to say that financial stability isn't a very important part of what the Fed should do, but I'm a little bit worried about just saying, let the Fed do it because they're sort of better than others at doing it. Which actually gets at one of the broad points that I want to make. I'll come to a couple of specifics. But in the broad regulatory reforms and steps going forward and how we can do things better, I was hoping for a little more boldness. One of the challenges that is really clearly outlined in the report, and we've seen whether it was most recently or a decade ago in the global financial crisis, is there are a lot of fragile interconnections between different markets, different types of institutions, and that's sort of it's in those cracks where there are a lot of problems that come in. And part of the reason that there are those cracks there is because the way we set our institutions up, we've got insurance regulators that are at the state level. We've got bank regulators. We've got regulators of other pieces of the system. And much like the report focuses on the so-called shadow banking system or the non-bank system, which I think is important because that's even more fragmented. It's a challenge because we have different authorities with particular focus. And then part of the solution, as proposed by the task force, is say, well, everyone should have their own financial stability group, and then there should be a Treasury financial stability group. And not that I think there's anything wrong with that, but I'm not quite sure that that really helps to get at the fundamental issue, which is sort of seeing those interconnections. If you have an organization that is a banking, to regulate banking or to regulate insurance or to regulate broker dealers, they're going to regulate those things primarily. Certainly, they'll be worried about the big picture risks, but the mandate that the Congress has given them is to look at, you know, one particular type of institution. I think that's where some of the problems come in and where some of the challenges are. And what's interesting is the task force, I think quite wisely, has found a lot of kind of those fragile interconnections. Just as Jeremy and Don and Glenn were talking about, treasuries are incredibly important. I mean, basically, they're the base of the entire financial system. And if that base wobbles, if there's not complete liquidity there or confidence that there's liquidity there, everything else fails. People just want to get rid of everything. If you can't get rid of treasuries, then you just run from everything else. And that has enormous consequences for every asset class, for every institution in the system. So it would seem that being bolder and sort of thinking across the, the column that you have on the credit disruption problems, those problems, those should be kind of the motivations for the regulatory approaches rather than the other pieces of breaking it down by insurance, by banking, by the particular institution, and really saying that what we want is an organization, not necessarily, I think, well coordinated with the Fed, but not necessarily just the Fed, to be looking at these kinds of issues. I'm not sure that just sort of coordinating amongst the different pieces is really going to be able to get at that. So I think looking at the class of problems of sort of, you know, the dash for cash, the liquidity problems, and in a number of places there are issues raised about what I've sometimes called toxic contracts, of contracts that are very, like, let's use CCP as an example. There are a lot of contracts around CCPs that are extremely good and extremely robust for dealing with a failure of a particular institution, but the unintended consequence of that is it can cause system-wide problems when everyone has to pony up resources at the same time, and so I think thinking about it from that perspective rather than from a CCP perspective, but think about it as, look, what are the stresses that are going to be when a shock comes on liquidity, on, you know, coming from CCPs, from others, and approaching it in that way would be important. Now I know that Glenn mentioned that didn't focus on cyber. And I understand that you can't focus on everything, but I do think that that is an element that really does cut across all of these pieces and shows that what's very important is not just banking and financial regulation, but also coordination with national security agencies. This is, I think, of stability and resilience is very much a part of that. Because there could be foreign actors who try to do something that could be problematic to the system. Just think about a cyber attack that makes a large financial institution just a little bit uncertain about what is in everyone's account. That's going to be really, really problematic. And that becomes not just a financial stability issue, but I think a broader issue. So thinking about it in those sort of very broad terms, going even more boldly forward than it's gone before, I think would be valuable. And thinking in particular about these so-called toxic contracts, the things that are very good for dealing with a particular institution or one particular problem, but haven't the unintended consequence of causing a market-wide problem, I think would be really valuable.
Thanks. Well, thank you for teeing up two things that I wanted to talk about. Let me start with Blythe, but let me say one thing first. You implied that the task force was not bold. In one respect, the task force is not bold deliberately, which is the task force decided in its first meeting not to propose consolidating financial regulators, like merging the CFTC and the SEC. None of the people on the task force would design a system the way it is now. But we felt that another group proposing something that seems unlikely to happen wasn't constructive. One of the questions I got online is somebody said, great presentation, many recommendations, not novel. I take that as a compliment. And then the questioner asked, but some of this, is it politically realistic? And I think what the task force did is a mix of things, some of which can be done by regulators, and the current crop of regulators is pretty much disposed to do things. Some things would have to be done by Congress, and that obviously is a bigger leap, but it seemed essential to at least put them on the table. Blythe, Randy referred to the clearinghouses for derivatives, and that's a subject about which you know quite a bit, but I think most people don't. And I wondered if you could talk about why you think that is something that poses a financial stability risk. And I referred to a question we got online where somebody said, oh, come on, the CCPs did fine during the crisis, and maybe people had to post more margin, but that can't have accounted for a lot of the dash for cash. So what's the problem here, and why do you think it should be addressed?
So as we know, the CCPs have performed a valuable role in the implementation of the much needed reforms in the aftermath of the great financial crisis. And the mandate to centrally clear derivatives has addressed many of the issues that led to contagion risk during that crisis. in that there is less open, unsecured exposure bilaterally in the system and less linkage that's opaque and hard to predict the consequences that there was before the central clearing mandate. The issue, though, is that by imposing a central clearing mandate, we have centralized a huge amount of activity and introduced a single or a series of single counterparties upon whom essentially everybody in the system is now dependent. And it's absolutely true that the CCP has fared well during the 2020 March crisis. But that doesn't mean that the systemic risk doesn't reside there. The issue is that the consequence of a failure of a CCP, particularly a derivative CCP, is actually almost unfathomably difficult to describe. The issue being with derivatives as distinct from securities, that derivatives have tenor. They are long-lived instruments, unlike a securities transaction where cash exchanges hands after typically 2 days, and that's essentially the end of the interdependency between a counterparty and the clearinghouse. In the case of derivatives, counterparties have long-term exposure. And if a clearinghouse were to fail, due perhaps to the correlated failure of several of its clearing members or customers, the result of that would be essentially an immediate freezing of and catastrophic ceasing of functioning of what would have quickly become all markets. Derivative markets are intimately linked with cash markets. They are what people use to hedge their cash exposures and vice versa. And a failure of a central counterparty would leave instantly the clearing members of that central counterparty with new risks on their books that arise suddenly because of the loss of the protection afforded them by the CCP. Those risks are open, they have duration, in some cases they have complexity as well, and second and third order effects. We like to call these Greeks. So they have risks that can be very hard to predict, and the ability to close out those risks would be severely impaired because of the very fact that the market that the CCPs seek to serve is the market you would have to enter to lay off those same risks. So there's certainly a significant systemic risk potentially there. The issues that the report raises, there's a lot of information in the derivatives CCP chapter. It talks about lack of sufficiency of skin in the game from privately owned or commercially owned CCPs that aren't mutualized. It talks about the fact that those entities have the right to call on the resources of their members in the event of a default in order to replenish their terms. They also have the right to force unwinds or haircuts. And all of these things can amount in a situation where there's misaligned interests between the CCP and their customers can amount to situations where the members essentially have risk and or financial loss or both imposed on them at a time when market functionality is compromised. We have never seen a failure of a major CCP, a derivative CCP, in the post-Dodd-Frank era, and I hope very much that we never will do. And just because it hasn't yet occurred doesn't mean that the risk does not exist. There is widespread commentary, both from the industry itself, the users of CCPs, the mandated users of CCPs, a number of academics, a number of current and former regulators about these issues. And it's time that we strengthen at least one entity in the constellation of fragmented regulators that we have in the US with taking responsibility for the systemic risk consequences of all of this. And that means not just regulation of an individual CCP, which of course already occurs, but thinking about the interconnectedness between them, thinking about the cross-border interconnectedness between them, thinking about the shared customers between them, and what a failure of one or more entities that are the biggest customers, not just of one CCP, but of many CCPs simultaneously could bring about. Thinking about how to ensure alignment of interest, sufficiency of skin in the game, ensuring that the consequences from a systemic risk point of view, as Randy referred to it, of a toxic contract that serves the CCP commercially well in managing its own risk, but has the potential to create contagion elsewhere. And that needs to be thought about, not from the resiliency point of view, not from the point of view of the CCP's commercial private interest, but the externalities that that imposes on the, or could impose upon the rest of the system. Pretty much all of the issues that we identified, with the exception of the pro-cyclicality of margins, apply principally or to a greater degree with respect to derivative CCPs than they do with security CCPs, again, because of the inherent nature and difference in nature of the underlying instruments. But pro-cyclicality of margin is something that there was a lot of noise around in back in March last year, and is something that is just as relevant in the security CCP space. So important to point out that there we did talk about consideration being given to through the cycle margining practices that are more stable inherently, but also a particular recommendation that's buried deep, but I want to lift up because I think it's important, which is giving consideration to shortening the settlement cycle in securities CCPs. It's not really so relevant or helpful in the case of derivatives because, again, they have long lives. But if you are to shorten the settlement cycle to from T plus two down to T plus one or potentially even less, the technologies exist, by the way, today to facilitate that. You would materially reduce the risk inherent, the systemic risk inherent in the system, and at the same time reduce the quantum of need for capital calls and the exacerbation that that can have in a situation where there's a dash for cash like the one that we otherwise described. One last comment, if I may take advantage of having the mic for a minute. I just wanted to mention something in response to Jeremy's good comments. But this issue of the moral hazard and the breadth of establishing of a Fed repo facility, I want to point out that the moral hazard that you felt that you haven't yet seen, I'd like to consider whether actually it exists in the form of the sheer extraordinary scale of the growth of open-ended mutual funds, which are offering products as alternatives to cash, which are widely used both by retail and increasingly institutional scale investors, which have grown since the financial crisis. Not a coincidence that they've grown during the same period that bank balance sheets have been increasingly constrained because of the SLR, G-SIB computations and other things. These alternatives, which are, to use your great terminology, capital light vehicles, are providing liquidity promises that vastly exceed their capacity in the absence of a helpful Fed to deliver in a dash for cash situation. So they hold liquidity buffers in the form of treasuries. They expect to be able to convert those to cash when they need to. That drove very much a big part of what was going on in March of 2020. There's a clear moral hazard issue there. And the reason for imposing a fee and a mandate on those entities for participation is to start to try to contain that dimension of the moral hazard risk. So did just want to get that one in, even though I got a little further.
Let me just define two things that you said for people who may not be familiar. When you talk about pro-cyclical margining, what you mean is that when the markets go down, suddenly everybody, all the clearinghouses want their customers to put up more margin, and that just tends to make things worse. And your reference to the settlement issue is that now when I sell a share of stock, The deal doesn't close for 3 days. And in the interim, there's a lot of money that needs to be financed and that thing. Kate, I'm going to turn to the Financial Stability Oversight Council. I mean, as Randy implied, the idea was, okay, if we're stuck with all these financial regulators, we did Dodd-Frank, we got rid of one, the Office of Thrift Supervision, and we created another one in the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. So net, no change. The idea was that the FSOC was going to be this great coordinating power. At least in the Trump administration, it seemed to be relatively impotent. I know that Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen seems determined to flex its muscles, but she's learned that it doesn't have very many muscles. So I'm curious how you think that what recommendations does the task force make to strengthen the FSOC, and what makes you think that this institution can be saved?
It's a great question to ask, and it does nicely follow, because I do think Randy raised a number of important issues. Going back to many of the chapters, I think the best way to understand the recommendations with respect to the FSOC is that the hope is you make a bunch of small changes that add up to being more of the sum of their parts. Again, one of the key challenges here is there is so much power that currently lies at the primary regulators. And so can we realistically promote resilience and stability unless we get buy-in, staff, support, and understanding at the level of those regulators? And we were skeptical of that. So we completely agree that with you that the cracks and the interconnections need to be at the center of efforts to identify potential threats. And that is key to the idea of creating not just the Undersecretary for Financial Stability within Treasury, but really creating a very significant staff there. So they are crafting the report. The report is not coming from a group of different regulators, it is coming from them. And they're saying, here's what's changed in the last 3 years. We've looked at the financial system, like here are the things that we're seeing, just the trends. Here's what we think potentially poses threats, really making recommendations. And then again, for the individual regulators, it's not just adding to their mandate, but building out the required staff. So there is the idea you'll have an office focused on financial stability and resilience within each of the different FSOC members, that office is going to report directly to the chair, that they're also going to coordinate with each other across the different agencies. And then you institutionalize this as well into the process. So one of the things we've learned over the past decade is we made a lot of very helpful changes, I think, in bank regulation, but they had collateral consequences on liquidity and market functioning. We also have regulators who traditionally have been market regulators, having to engage in what might look like efforts to address systemic threats, but without necessarily having the capacity or the internal background and frame for trying to understand how they should be thinking about those issues and where they should prioritize issues like capital formation, investor protection relative to financial stability. So we think providing a much clearer mandate, because as you said, the mandates are going to control what they do, making it clear that it applies to the whole agency, creating the staff, and then creating these annual mechanisms as well as others to promote the coordination and communication, along with, the more robust comptroller of data and resilience, because a lot of the challenge is just understanding what's flowing and where. We're at least taking a very meaningful step forward. So I don't know if it's a solution. It's not meant to be a solution, but I do think hopefully it gets us to the point where we have more continued attention on resilience. And actually, let me tie that really quickly to a point made by Jeremy, but also came up in the question pointed given to Blythe. One of the core challenges we face is right now, nobody's all that interested in financial stability. You know, there is this overall sense of, you know, that was the problem of a decade ago. We're in a new era. We have different issues. We just managed to get through a pandemic. We didn't see anything explode in a major way. Therefore, we really don't have to worry about these issues. But I think, as Jeremy rightly noted, not only did the Fed step in a major way, but we had Congress step in a very significant way. Neither of those can be taken for granted in the face of a future potential threat to stability. And so I think the need for ongoing diligence and the need to be thinking about it now, precisely when nobody thinks we need to be thinking about it, is part of what we need to institutionalize when we're trying to institutionalize through the reforms. So I think there's certainly other ways we could go about it, but part of it is that understanding. It's precisely when you're not paying attention to these issues that potentially we most need to be.
Thank you. Anil, you're in many respects, the father of this report. You proposed a study like this at a Fed conference a couple of years ago that we took up the challenge. So I'm curious, just if you could step back, what is it in the report that we haven't discussed that you think is worthy of note? And what do you think about separately Jeremy's point that we shouldn't charge an upfront fee for the Treasury Liquidity Facility?
Well, let me take the second one first. I think Blythe pointed out part of the thing. So we would insist that the principal trading firms have to pay this access fee, partly to tax them. So they'd be capital light, but they'd be mandated if they're going to be in there during the normal times to have to pay something so that when they do step back, at least they don't completely escape all of this. They may or may not use it. I think we tried to say that there have to be enough people mandated to touch the facility that you'd be sure to set a floor under the price of the treasuries, which in the end is the single most important thing, that we don't have a fire sale. So I think this is a complicated calculation, and the task force debated it quite a bit actually. But I think the key idea is that there would be a floor on the price of treasuries and everybody would understand that, and that we wouldn't see anything like what we saw for those 2 weeks in March before the Fed stepped in. I mean, I wonder how many people even watching this call realized that in the first and second quarters of last year, the Fed bought more than it did in the sum of QE1, QE2, and QE3. It's a huge intervention that I don't think most people appreciate. And I don't think we want to have to count on that again. Stepping back, I think what Kate was just talking about is incredibly important, because we've watched the FSOC kind of flop around from the point where when the administration changed, as Glenn was saying, people are policy, that they dropped a lawsuit that the two previous chairs of the FSOC wrote and had to say, why are you doing this? So that shows you how little institutional commitment there was to something that I think was in plain sight. And a lot of the topics we're taking up in this report are ones that have been festering for 6-8 years, and the system clearly isn't self-correcting. So I think part of the way the FSOC is going to evolve, if we were a dictator and got to impose all this, would make it a much more organic and dynamic organization that would be forced to kind of keep up. Kate didn't mention that every agency would still have an annex to the report that it would be talking about. So it would be impossible were something to go wrong in our setup where it wouldn't be clear who let down the system, because there would have been somebody responsible for each part of it. Either it would have been the Treasury Secretary that gave something a pass, or the agencies that failed to spot it, or the OFR that failed to get the data. And so I think that would be a first order improvement. Something that we didn't talk about is just how risky insurance has become. The insurance industry has transformed itself over the last half dozen years in a way that before I started working on this, I didn't appreciate. During the first 3 or 4 weeks of the pandemic, the insurance companies were down more than the airlines. You know, I say, how can that happen? Well, because the insurance industry is now a variable annuity industry. And when it looked like interest rates were going to stay low for a very long time, people stepped back and calculated the value of the insurance companies and said, my God, these guys are in real trouble. And so that happened. It got very little commentary. There's nothing in the current system that's going to fix it. And it's a ticking time bomb that's just sitting there. And it's wrong that we're going to have no real way to address it. I think if our reforms went through, that would be an example of something that's visible but not headed towards correction, and where we're going to have remorse if something goes badly. And so I like the institutional reform that would clear up, everything that we can see now, and also have a more of a horizon scanning nature to it, where somebody would be responsible for looking out there and saying, what's growing fast? You know, what's exploded in the last couple of years? Let's go try to figure out why and what would happen if it went wrong. And let me stop there because we're running out of time for questions.
To my surprise, there seem to be more questions about the clearinghouses than anything else. So, Blythe, you're on. One, how would you align the interests of the members of the profit or the privately held CCPs and their members? Two, how would you address recovery and resolution? And who would do these stress tests? And would you give the CCPs access to the Fed standing repo facility?
So, you know, the alignment of interest comes starts with insisting on greater skin in the game. That means increasing the amount of capital deployed by the operator of the CCP so that its interests and those of the members who all would then more in a more aligned fashion stand to lose in the event of a failure are more closely aligned.
That was something that a regulator would have to require, presumably.
Presumably.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think the next, the other point, by the way, is it should come early enough in the waterfall of who absorbs default, or who absorbs losses and in what sequence to matter. So it should be at the top of the waterfall because these are the operators of the CCP. And, you know, presently, that's not always the case, that their capital is at the top of the waterfall. So often member capital is what gets depended on in the default fund is what gets depended on first. Again, lack of alignment there. Tell me the second question again.
So how would you address recovery and resolution? Would you give them access to the repo facility at the Fed?
Yeah. So, I mean, we talked about in the chapter on this, which goes into a lot of, you know, a lot of detail, but not enough detail to answer by any means all questions on this subject. We talked about broadening the role of the Fed in CCP, in overseeing CCP resilience vis-a-vis systemic issues, as well as involvement in recovery and resolution. Presently, the FDIC has the unenviable task of dealing with CCP resolution, and absolutely no offense intended to the FDIC, but again, as I've described it, unfathomably bad eventuality. And I think having a regulator with a mandate that is broader, you know, across the entire system, thinking about that with a view to systemic stability is important. I think practically the only viable choice in that context would be the Fed. So that's what we recommended is broadening their role in respect of that. The question of giving access, CCPs that are designated as SIFMUs, systemically important financial market utilities, I think that might stand for, forgive me if I got it wrong, in principle, under certain circumstances, given access to the discount window, but it's more in an in extremis case, I believe, than with a view to thinking about an individually in extremis case, rather than in connection with stemming a broader systemic event. There is the issue that other CCPs that are not SIFMUs, for example, foreign CCPs that are very important to the US financial system nonetheless, there are huge interlinkages there, both with respect to overlapping products and overlapping members. There's a question as to whether they should be given such access. But under all circumstances, you would have wanted to create skin in the game, capital requirements, supervisory oversight and a clear mechanism for the Fed to conclude that there was sufficient supervision before you would ever contemplate giving access to the discount window, I believe. And then I think I see now there was another question on stress tests. How could these be improved? Well, number one, transparency, greater transparency around the methodologies. Number two, I'm much more interested in cross-market stress tests than I am in individual institution stress tests. You want to look at common holdings, common counterparties, and run stress tests across the system, including thinking about cross-border implications, not just individual scenarios. So it would be typical today for a CCP to run a stress test that says, what if our largest single counterparty failed? What if our largest two single counterparties failed? That doesn't get anywhere close to, and do we have enough capital to cover that? That is not even approaching a sufficient set of questions to answer what are the systemic risk consequences system-wide of something like that happening? Because, by the way, if your top two counterparties in this exchange or CCP system fail, there are obvious implications elsewhere. Reverse stress testing is something that both Anil and I also like. This is the concept of asking of the stressee, define a stress test that illustrates your worst imaginable outcome. You tell us what that would be rather than imposing that on them. So reverse stress testing for CCPs and groups of CCPs, I think, would be extremely valuable. Extremely valuable. There's lots of evidence to suggest that there's correlations that occur in times of stress in terms of stress causes greater correlations of positions across counterparties, greater concentrations of positions, and behavior in times of stress can be very different than in times of normality. So Understanding and beginning to think about that, and I think reverse stress testing could be very helpful in terms of thinking through some of the consequences of that. So
thank you. So I think
I could go on, but
no, I know you can.
Could I just recommend an excellent paper by someone, unfortunately, who's no longer with us, or one of the two authors? It's called "A CCP is a CCP is a CCP," by Robert Cox and Steigerwald. And it gets at exactly this issue that that Blythe is talking about how do you regulate these appropriately and how does the Fed do it? And what's interesting, and it gets back to a discussion we had earlier, is although they're at the Chicago Fed, they're implicitly critical of the Fed taking an approach that treats a CCP as a bank rather than treats it as a different kind of institution. And I think that's one of the institutional challenges that you have, that even if you create these groups of resiliency and stress organizations in each organization, they're still going to be looking at it from their particular point of view.
Right. I think one of the virtues of this report is that it raises issues that seem arcane and not on the front pages until something blows up and suddenly we'll be wondering, like, why weren't we more concerned about CCPs or what was with this variable annuity business? So I think that that's one of the values. Kate, very briefly, there was one question that we discussed and I thought you could answer before I turn it back to Don and Glenn, which is, does it make sense to have the FSOC in the Treasury if the Treasury is always changing from one administration to another?
You know, it's a key question. We went around it over and over and over again. One of the things that is in the background, but not dispositive, but we did have another Supreme Court decision just last week reiterating what they found earlier, which is that when you have a single head, they're going to have to be directly accountable to the president. So if what you're trying to avoid is presidential politics, there are, you know, there's open issues, but there's certain reasons to be concerned that whether it's Treasury or not. That being said, there are also advantages. I mean, I think going back to Neil's point about accountability, this creates accountability in a way that is meaningful and does tie to where you want it to be. And where, as a practical matter, ex post, the Treasury Secretary is always running things when things go badly. And so I think one of the things that we like about having some treasury is if this is where the center of control, the locus of control is going to be during periods of distress, we want them to be part of the ongoing conversation and also of ongoing accountability to being paying attention to these issues. So they're shifting the hat rather than coming into a whole new territory during those periods. So there's more to say, but I do think it's a difficult call and some real advantages.
I want to thank all five of the panelists. One of the disadvantages of having five panelists, all of whom are extremely experienced, is you kind of wish you could have twice as much time with each one of them, but then there's the externality there with the other panelists. Before we close, though, I want to turn the mic back over to Don Cohn and Glenn Hubbard for some closing remarks. But thank you all for participating.
Thank you. Thank you, David. So just a couple of brief remarks. First of all, thank you, certainly to everybody on the task force. This was a great experience for me, and I think we've produced a document that doesn't have all the answers, for sure, but points to a lot of problems and a lot of places that need work, and I hope will be a reference work for both the Congress and the regulators going forward. And thank you especially to Randy and Jeremy for those very thoughtful reactions. Two points here. One is to emphasize a point that was made, which is the task force was formed before March of 2020. We were formed in the fall of 2019, as Glenn pointed out, so that there are a lot of issues. There's a tendency, I think, today to focus on what went wrong in March of 2020. And to a considerable extent, what went wrong in March of 2020 was indicative of some underlying problems, but those underlying problems were there already. So even as March of 2020 fades into the rearview mirror, for the reasons that have been expressed, it took the Fed and the Congress, but also there were problems there before. We needed to look very carefully at non-bank finance and the vulnerabilities there, and to reconfigure, rethink about how we were approaching them and how we could make the system safer so it continue to operate in bad times as well as good. And that brings me to my second point. This, our focus was on what happens in a stress situation. Does the financial system absorb that stress and allow and continue to provide services to households, businesses, and governments that they need to continue operating, or does it amplify that stress? And what we've discovered are there are certain aspects of the system that would tend to amplify it, would tend to make it worse, would tend to make it spill over to the economy. And it may be, and a lot of some of our recommendations anyhow, might be that you have to incur a little bit of cost in the good times to buy that insurance against the stress times. And just because there's some extra cost in normal times doesn't mean you shouldn't be paying that insurance fee so that the financial system works with the economy instead of against it in bad times. Glenn?
Yeah, I would just add a couple of things to what Don said. First, you know, thanks to Randy and Jeremy for joining us. Our purpose in doing this was to join in and hopefully advance a conversation. And any serious long-term policy challenge, one writes for the file, meaning you prepare things, you prepare ideas, you have a conversation with policymakers and meet the market test, as we did in this panel today. And I think that's very, very important. I very much appreciate the alternative explanations that Jeremy pointed us to, and also the alternative organization, more of a matrix approach that Randy pointed us to, and would urge anybody viewing the webinar now or in the future who has a point to make to reach out to us. This is going to be an important subject because these pennies always do turn, but we want to be ready, and we're grateful to everybody for joining us today. Thank you.